Good morning. I'm Elke Lorenz, today's convener and a member of this fellowship. Welcome to our members, friends, and guests. The Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan is a community of people who celebrate multiple religious traditions. We believe that faith is ultimately to be experienced in how we live. We have no creed or dogmas, but we do invite one another to reflect on how our lives hold up when looked through the eyes of our principles and values that you find on the back of your order of service. Come into this place of peace and let its silence heal your spirit. Come into this place of memory and let its history warm your soul. Come into this place of prophecy and power and let its vision change your heart. Welcome. If we have any guests that would like to introduce themselves or be introduced, please do so at this time.
The Prairie Cluster Retreat was a really nice time, and I actually brought someone back, Sylvia Crestwell. She decided to come visit, so sure.
Thank you, Jennifer, and welcome. We are going to light the chalice. Be ours a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere, its temple all space, its shrine the good heart, its creed all truth, its ritual work of love, its profession of faith, divine living. Please refer to announcements in the order of service. I have two additional announcements to make. The session on deepening your understanding of UUism will meet at 12:15 after the service with our minister, Michael Nelson, here in the main sanctuary. Our second announcement is, if you will be shopping at Dillon's, Ray's Apple Market, or Hy-Vee, this week, make sure you buy your gift card that benefits the fellowship. Marissa Larson is here to help you if you want to buy those things. Our next item is opening hymn number 191. Please stand as you're able to. It is now time to share our joys and concerns to help us celebrating with the joys and help with the burdens. Who has a joy or a concern today?
Jim Chanteau. Actually, I have three joys. The first is last Thursday I received a phone call from Marilyn Caldwell and Steve Mull. They have now moved into their home in upstate New York. They have not. They have now. That's what they said. Yeah, they have now. They are in. They are in the home now. Marilyn says it needs lots of work. Second joy is we had a fellowship dinner on Friday night and had a marvelous time. Ann Cowan hosted it, and those of us that were there really enjoyed it. There's another sign up out in the narthex for those that would like to join us next month, the beginning of November. And finally, the number that the choir is singing today, I noticed, I didn't realize this until I arrived for the rehearsal, is based on words from St. Francis of Assisi. Last summer, I sang with the Flint Hills Masterworks Chorale, and we toured Italy, and we actually sang in Assisi, in the Basilica of St. Francis of Assisi. And while there, I learned something about the man. He was really quite amazing. He started an order which, to my knowledge, is the only Catholic order which allows both men and women to be monks or whatever they are, together. They have no distinction between men and women. He didn't believe that such a distinction made sense. He also gave up all worldly goods. He was a vow of poverty, and he really believed it. So, amazing man.
Hi, Kathy Hedge. I have a joy that my sister, I've shared with several of you, is it has some very serious neurological things going on, so she's losing her career as a children's entertainer, which she's done for 20 years. But this week, she received the award for the top arts educator of the year for the whole Sacramento area. And in the article, they said she was the premier children's entertainer of Northern California. So it was a wonderful, wonderful gift.
We have no more joys and concerns. It's now time for the choir to come up.
We find the way of peace.
It is time for the children's story, as we are told loud and clear here. Not loud, but clear.
Yes. Today, the adults are talking about memories today, and I thought that would be a good, actually, Bryce Hopebrook thought it would be a good idea to talk with you about memories as well. What is a memory? Yes?
A memory is like one of the things that happened in the past that you remember.
Yes, that's a very good explanation. I don't think anybody could have done it much better than that. Okay, what is the first thing that you all remember? The first thing, yes.
Memories are something when you get older and when you die.
Oh, yes, that's very true. Good explanation, yes. Oh, my goodness. Yes?
One of the first memories that I remember is my old
house. Uh-huh. That's a very good memory, and that will probably stay with you for the rest of your life. You will remember your old house. Other early memories that you have? Yes?
I remember going to California this summer.
Uh-huh. Very good. Other memories? Yes. So, some memories are happier than others, aren't they? Yes.
I have a sad memory that once I jumped off the diving board backwards and I got a bad scrape right here.
Yes. That is a memory that you will probably stay with you too. Did you learn something from your memories? Do we learn from memories?
Yes.
What did you learn from a memory? Anybody else? Just a second. You will get your turn. What did you learn from a memory? Yes?
You can learn from a memory that you won't do it anymore.
Yes, that's very true. Okay. That's very true. Or, what else could you learn from a memory? You can do it again because it was so much fun. Yes. What else? How do we store memories? What do we need to be able to store memories? Yes?
Brain.
Your brain. And what does your brain store? How does your brain store memories? What does it need to store the memories? It's all up here, most of it at least. What do you need? Yes? Stories help?
No, the storm.
Oh, the storm is a memory too. Yes, very much so. I have many memories of storms.
Help people die.
Sometimes that can happen, and that's actually very sad, but yes, that can happen. But what do you remember? How do you remember your house? What do you need to remember your old house? How do you... Yes. Mm-hmm. So your eyes, what else do you need to have? Yes, Nick. Yes, you have to have done it or experienced it. Sometimes you just see it with your eyes. What other senses do we have that help us? What are our senses that help us store? Yes. The eyes, what else?
Ears.
Touch, yes. Tasting, and one more.
Smelling.
Okay. So, very good. We need all these senses to help us with memories. What about stories? Do you remember a lot of stories that others have told you?
No.
No? Yeah, a lot of stories. Who tells you stories? And your friends, yes?
Teachers.
Your teachers? Do you think you will remember the stories your teachers tell you?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. What was it? A folk tale, yes. And, you know, it's good that you mentioned folk tales because they go from generation to generation and they have been with us for hundreds of years because like teachers like yours tell it to the children, and then they can tell it to their children and their grandchildren, and that's how they stay with us, all these stories. So, any other thing you would like to add to our conversation about memories? No? Okay, then you can go to your classrooms now. Go. We have Judy Davis here to represent the Crisis Center. Our offertory today, unless a check is marked for UUFM pledge, will go to the Crisis Center. So please be generous. I'm sure they can help you, need your help.
Good morning. Thank you for giving me a couple of minutes of your very precious time. I've watched this fellowship over the years, and wow, the vitality here is marvelous. The Crisis Center was incorporated locally in 1981 to provide free and confidential services to victims of sexual and domestic violence in our five-county regional community. This fellowship is a part of the fabric of the Crisis Center. This is one of the organizations that has sustained us for all of these years. We offer 24-hour crisis hotlines, and to give you some sense of the magnitude, we answered nearly 2,300 of those last year. We provide 24-hour face-to-face crisis intervention and advocacy in a variety of venues on behalf of victims. And at the center of everything is our safe shelter. And it is to the safe shelter that your gifts today will go. Last year, we provided just under 5,000 nights of shelter to victims of domestic violence and their children. And as of August 31 of this year, we had provided nearly 4,500 nights. Sadly, as we are on track to set a record probably for nights of necessary safe shelter, a number of different sources of public funding, and you will have heard this song before, are diminishing, 1,000 here, 5,000 there, 10,000 there. This year it hit us particularly hard because a major source of shelter operations funding left a 2-month gap. That was just July and August when the West Star bill was $500 at the shelter. Oh, and we had to replace the burner on a hot water heater. And oh, we had a bat in the shelter. That's $190 in case you're wondering. By the time you call the people to get it and then you take it to K-State. So I'm here to promise you that whatever you can share today will be put to good use for a very, very good cause. And I thank you again for all of your support.
Thank you very much, Slavomir. I will now turn over the program to Bryce Holbrook. He is the former dean of libraries at K-State University and a longtime member of this fellowship. He is talking about managing memories and listening to voices of the past.
He will guide you through the rest of the service. Thank you.
Thank you, Elka. This reading is entitled Cows Roaming the Meadows of Our Past. It's a bit folksy, but Shirley thinks I'm just an old farm boy at heart. But the better point is that we never really leave behind the origins, our origins, where we came from and how we thought, and it's just there always with you. This is, the title is actually extracted from the reading itself. It wasn't titled that. This is from, written by Jill Lepore in The New Yorker, June 25th, 2012, under the title An Origin Story. And it goes like this. One night in November 1935, a flashy swing band singer named Beach Powers, age 23, was driving down a lonesome stretch of Route 54, about 10 miles outside Eureka, Kansas, with Claude Forshee, age 21, and their dates, the 15-year-old twins, Evelyn and Dorothy Coolscott. They were on their way to El Dorado to see a movie. A cow wandered onto the road. Powers swerved to avoid it, only to crash into a tanker truck filled with gasoline. As you can imagine, no one survived the crash. Someone else was supposed to be there in the car that night, 17-year-old Stanley Dunham, but his grandmother had made him stay home. Every family has a chancy cow or two roaming in the meadows of its past. The reason that anyone other than the Dunhams knows the story of this stray cow is because a lifetime later, Stanley Dunham's grandson was elected president of the United States. David Marinus, editor of the Washington Post, and editor at the Washington Post, adds to this by saying, if you tell a life backwards, it will be filled with contingencies, and whatever happens later seems at once unlikely and foreordained. I believe that life is chaotic, a jumble of accidents, ambitions, misconceptions, bold intentions, lazy happenstances, and unintended consequences. Yet, I believe that there are connections that illuminate our world, revealing its endless mystery and wonder. Marinus goes on to say, this is how history works, a history of families as well as history of nations and movements, along with rational processes of biology and geography, of politics and economics. There are some seemingly random connections that spin out profound and unintended consequences. It seems to me, as we sit here today, it is remarkable that each of us is here because we are all just a product of chance. Think what might have happened in your ancestry or personal experience that would change who you are or any or all of your experiences. How many stray cows are there in your past? Well, my topic is really managing memories, and that's just a convenient catch-all for talking about looking at one's past and recording those memories for those who might care about who we might be or who we were. As we listen to the voices of our past, gathering meaning and spirituality from our origins is really the nature of what I want to organize this around today. Do not be misled thinking this is about memory management. That would suggest we will avoid how to avoid forgetting things in early dementia. We won't do that, even though it's well known that each of us loses 0.25% of our brain cells beginning at age 30 each year, and by the time we are 80, we will have lost 20% of our brain cells. So if you're in that age range, there's a reason why things slip away. That name you can't remember quickly, in today's generation, I think it's just sensory overload. The iPod in your ear and the smartphone in your hand and all of the distractions, that's why nobody remembers anything today. Younger people should not fear early dementia necessarily. Well, when the program committee asked me to speak, it was premised by Dave on the rumor that I was known to tell stories about my life and experiences growing up in the Great Plains. I have read several stories here in the past, such as The Inferno, The Banker in the Cornfield, Elmer and the Bull, and many others. But I have been actively working on memoirs and family history for the last 8 years, and I got my start writing these things with a personal journey given here in 1998. That's chapter one of my memoir. I also learned that the program committee expects a spiritual component in every talk that is given here, so I have tried to do that today. I must say that I owe a lot of credit to Charlie Kempthorne and Barbara Bascom. Otherwise, I wouldn't be writing anything at all. A memoir writing group here at the Fellowship some years ago got me and others started into this. And seriously, I wouldn't have written anything. There would be nothing if that had not occurred. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to talk about several things that relate to memory. I'll try not to get too heavy on the science of anything, what I'd like to talk about is the meaning of time, some thoughts about human memory, what is the nature of external memory and what does it mean to us, and how do we derive spirituality from our memories. And then I'm going to intermix stories about some things along the way. I have written 4 or 5 new stories. You will be the first to hear them if we get to them here for this occasion, and we'll see what happens. Well, I must say that genealogy is one of the fastest growing sports in America. Ancestry.com, the largest internet provider of family records, I believe based on the Mormon archives, has 2 million subscribers and posts many documents like wills, census, and birth certificates. And some have called Ancestry.com Facebook for the dead. I personally have not found it very useful, getting much better results from the source documents by actually traveling to historical societies and visiting places where things actually happened. Ultimately, these things are based on one's personal desire to know and to personally interact with the records of one's past and to commune directly with the ghosts of those past. We must be mindful of the legacy that we leave for the future. How will your grandchildren know anything about you? Who was Grandpa? Who was Grandma? Actually, our greatest concerns about memory and its loss these days should come from the technology that we experience today. Digital cameras, smartphones, hard drives, thumb drives, CDs, DVDs. What confidence do you have that any of your memories will be preserved? I am an information professional, so to speak, and my experience is that every format, every electronic format that I encountered in the last 30 years became unreadable after a certain time unless some action was taken to preserve it in a readable text format. Nobody writes letters anymore. How will you find out what people were thinking? Nobody does diaries. What is your record going to be? Text messages and tweets? Okay, a little story to illustrate my point. This is titled The Passing of Little Blue. I am sad to report the passing of a member of our household this morning, our 9-year-old desktop computer, Little Blue. She had been declining for some time, booting up more slowly in recent months, taking longer to respond to commands, and showing signs of her advanced age, which is 21 in dog years. Little Blue was a sleek blue and gray beauty with a 330-bit Celeron processor, 512-megabit RAM memory, and an 80-gigabit hard drive. She didn't show her age, however, even though we did not agree to provide Botox injections or cosmetic surgery. Well, we had to take her to the emergency room on a few occasions with a virus. And sure, even though we've been very quiet about this, she had to be dewormed on one occasion. We did not realize that the years of repeated power ups and power downs had left her silicon chip worn and tired, connections frayed. Memories were lost and names could not be retrieved. Electrons no longer passed in the right pathways, and she would freeze if she became confused. I am sad because Little Blue held all of my writings from the past 10 years stored on her hard drive. Sure, there were a few things on thumb drives and DVDs, but she has taken most of my memories to computer heaven. I had planned to bequeath her hard drive to my grandson, but now there is nothing. My life experiences and family history are lost forever. Actually, that's not true. This is all a lie. But I write this to illustrate the point. Well, I'm going to cover three things, as I said. I'm going to talk about time, memory, external memory, and spirituality. What about time? Well, time is important, because what are our memories but elapsed time, right? Time that has passed, this instant, suddenly, immediately passes into past time. It is a memory. Anything I say now becomes a memory. It's elapsed. But what is time? Is time an illusion? Is time real, or is it just something that poets and philosophers talk about, and what is its meaning? Science confirms that our universe is like a giant clock that was wound with a beginning and is slowly unwinding with a regular cadence. And I say all of these things with some risk because of the physicists that are present here today. Time began. What this means is that for time to be real, we must have a beginning and we must have an end. And everything in between rolls out in regular cadence. Never mind that the scale is human, but the fact that it is based upon natural occurrences like the rotation of the Earth and the orbit around the sun and many other things. Well, time had a beginning. Time began with the Big Bang, and this is thoroughly convincing based on repeatable evidence that almost everyone agrees to. Even the Pope accepts the idea of the Big Bang, although he interprets it as evidence for a creator. Everyone, except school boards and legislatures, know that the universe is not static, but began 13.72 billion years ago, that's four significant figures, in an incredibly hot, dense event a few millimeters across. Energy became so dense that it transformed into particles that coalesced in fractions of seconds and then expanded by 10 to the 78th power in a fraction of a second, which is 10 to the minus 36 second. Well, don't worry yourself with those times, but that would all happen very quickly. This is when time began. The clock spring was wound and began to tick. Thus, our universe had a beginning and it will have an end. The end is estimated to be trillions of years in the distance when continuing expansion caused the night sky to empty and within galaxy clusters, matter will have collapsed into black holes. Do not fear. Our sun will have exhausted its hydrogen fuel and expand into a red giant that will envelop our whole solar system in 4 billion years. Never mind, humans will have made Earth uninhabitable long before. Well, we need to be concerned about time because we need to take advantage of our time here and gather meaning from that time. Well, I will probably need to skip a bunch of this stuff, but There are questions about can time run faster or slower, or is it always even? Well, Einstein's special theory of relativity tells us that time can be altered if objects run faster. If we travel very fast, we will get younger. An airplane journey may slow your aging by a microsecond or two. If we accelerate a spaceship to the speed of sound and travel to another star system, 25,000 light years in the distance, we will arrive 10 years younger. Think about the return trip. You'll get 10 years older. There is a cosmic speed limit. It is the speed of light. Our concept of our environment includes four dimensions. Three are spatial, and the fourth is time. Never mind that Einstein lumped time with space into space-time. That confuses all of us, unless we understand that that is just a convenience to make the mathematics easier. I believe that there's a practical side to relativity. I will later, if I have time, talk about the theory of memory relativity, something of my own doing. In fact, I'm going to skip memory relativity at this point, so we leave time for questions and discussion. I do not want to fail, however, to mention the use of the expression at this point in time. Remember how about 20 years ago, computer jockeys began to, every statement that they made, they prefaced it, was at this point in time. And we all sneered at it and said, oh, baloney, you don't know what you're talking about. But in fact, that's true. Time is real. It's on a distinctive journey from beginning to end. And to say at this point in time is correct. However, it is redundant. It'd be easier to say at this time, wouldn't it? Okay, but you can quarrel if you wish. Okay, now I'd like to talk about memory and human consciousness. The human brain distinguishes us from lower animals. Although lower animals have nerve control centers of various capacities, depending on numbers of cells and other structural considerations, the human brain size, about 3 pounds, and its structure based dedicating various parts to certain functions have evolved to make Homo sapiens, which means thinking man, the master, as far as we know, of the universe. So how does the brain work? This is my description of the brain. The human brain is a bioelectrochemical information storage and processing center controlling our biomechanical machine bodies. That'll think about that a minute. It's bio, it's electrical, it's chemical, and it stores information, our memories, and it is cognitive. It allows us to take those memories and process them into new thoughts. So that, I think, is a fairly accurate description of our human brain. Our brains contain 100 billion neurons, or nerve cells, or just cells, which gather and transmit signals. There are 100 trillion electrical connections among these cells, and not one cell touches any other. Connections known as synapses allow information to pass as electrical signals from one neuron to another. Each cell can have up to 40,000 connections. Learning and information happens by establishing a new connection. When we see something, our eye sends it to the brain, and it establishes a new connection, and we will remember it sometimes. When these connections deteriorate, we have memory loss and changes in brain function. Deterioration is associated with disuse, lack of mentally stimulating tasks, stress, drug use, excessive alcohol use, and chemicals in certain pesticides. I will not go into further detail about the brain, the different parts of the brain, but there are places that are dedicated to short-term and long-term memory. It is a very complex organism, and there is much study today about exactly how it works. My statement that it is a bioelectric device, however, it does carry a voltage, and if you apply electrodes to the brain, of course, you can stimulate the various functions based on where you put the electrodes into the brain, and you can understand. I've forgotten what voltage the brain carries. It's something like 12 volts or something like that. What we conclude from this is that our brains are giant integrated circuits capable of information retrieval and cognition. Well, I do want to mention something called silicon memory. It is appropriate to call human memory carbon memory, because carbon, with its very unique chemical properties, is key to the formation of organic compounds that make up living cells. It just so happens that silicon has the same electronic structure as carbon. In the periodic table, carbon, silicon, germanium, tin, and lead. Even germanium has some characteristics that are interesting. Carbon is essential to life. Everyone knows that. It's a possibility that maybe there are other universes, other planets, where there is a life system based on silicon. But the interesting thing is that humans have developed a new type of memory and cognition device called the electronic computer. It is not just a coincidence that electronic computers operate using integrated circuits on elemental silicon. The smartphones, the iPods, the iPads that we use today, and who knows what lies beyond, do we see a future where carbon and silicon memories are directly electrically connected? Well, already you see people wandering around with things in their ears. Well, we do have these devices attached directly to humans and smartphones. Well, the seers of our time say it won't be long before we have silicon memory computers plugged, interacting electrically directly with our carbon brains. So, and I don't doubt it. There's been so much happening that's probably true. I want to say a word about cosmic memory. There's more to memory than just what humans remain. There's the tree paradox, of course. If a tree falls in the forest and nobody was there to hear it, did it really happen? Well, of course it did. In fact, there's a whole lot that's happened in the last 13.72 billion years ago for which there is a signature memory. The Big Bang can be dated, and in fact, it can be observed, because astronomers have discovered in the last few years that the radiation left over from the Big Bang is still just arriving, and we can pick it up. In fact, we can see it. Your TV set with snow on the screen when nothing is transmitting, a portion of that is from the cosmic microwave background radiation, the evidence from the Big Bang. Pretty heady stuff, but it's true. There's general agreement on this thing. The dating of the universe, the observation of the receding galaxies, all of this constitutes a cosmic memory and allows us to back calculate to when the universe began. So I have to call it cosmic memory. Look, obviously, there are others. Records left behind, like geology and fossils and other things, that tell us something about the past. I want to give you some time to comment later, so I'm going to move ahead quickly to spirituality. Robert C. Fuller has a definition for spirituality that surprisingly is appropriate for this group. And I'm going to read this, and it's no mystery, it's on Wikipedia. So this is the quote from Robert C. Fuller. Spirituality exists wherever we struggle with the issues of how our lives fit into the greater scheme of things. This is true when our questions never give way to specific answers or give rise to specific practices such as prayer or meditation. We encounter spiritual issues every time we wonder where the universe comes from, why we are here, or what happens when we die. We also become spiritual when we become moved by values such as beauty, love, or creativity that seem to reveal a meaning or power beyond our visible world. An idea or a practice is spiritual when it reveals our personal desire to establish a relationship with the deepest meaning of the powers governing life. I think that's a fairly good way to talk about spirituality. And some of my own thoughts and how to relate this to memories are the following. Spiritual feelings are very personal. If you return to the place you were born and try to visualize your memories of having been there or having been with your parents there at an earlier time, can raise very spiritual meanings. For me, standing in a cornfield on the road in Illinois, beside the graves of great-grandparents, looking across the landscape that they saw, standing in the field, standing by the field mill in Lower Saxony in Germany, surrounded by the mists of the Wayan Mountains, knowing that my grandparents, multiple sets of grandparents, were born there and lived on this exact site. Nothing much has changed, and it's easy to transport oneself mentally back. In fact, it's easy to transport yourself mentally into the stories that you're writing about people. I know a number of you who write this kind of thing have experienced this. Channeling your feelings, I don't know. I'm not like Shirley MacLaine, who believes that she's able to establish connections with those of the past, but I do claim that for me, it is a spiritual experience to be able to write and experience these kinds of things. Writing is hard, but if you do something you're enjoying, it's not hard, and it's easy to get great pleasure from considering these events. Okay, I am going to move now to a story or two that I've written especially for this. Writing stories about things is much more interesting than just simple narrative of facts. Well, I went on a trip and I did this and I did so on and then I came home. Well, that's not interesting narrative necessarily. So my strategy is to write stories about things I did not experience and put life to them, or to write stories about things I did experience. Maybe we'll be able to do a couple. The first one is titled A Homecoming, a memoir of 1909. The characters here are my maternal grandfather and grandmother, and my mother and her two brothers. The little family sat in the one-horse high-wheeled carriage at the railroad station, anxiously waiting the noon passenger and mail train on the Lincoln Branch line. The two-mile trip to town from the Pleasant Ridge Farm followed rutted dirt roads and then crossed a low-water bridge over Paradise Creek. The trip had been bumpy, and the children were cross. The oldest son, Cecil, my mother's oldest brother, was proud of his temporary man of the family role and maintained a stiff posture, anticipating that he would soon see his father. Other townspeople drifted in from the streets, alleys, modest homes, and stores along Main Street, just like at the OK Corral. The coming of the mail train meant that their orders from Montgomery Ward would arrive along with family and strangers. The daily jitney was a high point of their day, every day. The horse switched flies off his rump, tossed his head, snorted, and impatiently shifted his feet. He was glad to rest and eyed the watering trough, wondering if he was going to get a drink before starting the homeward trip. The station agent and his helper bustled about, preparing to take off the mail, freight, egg crates, poultry cages, and cream cans, and help the ladies with their long skirts disembark. Maybe if they were lucky, they'd get a glimpse of an ankle. The steel-wheeled freight wagon stood ready. Myrtle's three children, Cecil 12, Werner 7, and Isla 18 months, complained of the heat on this unseasonably hot July 9th, 1909 morning. The carriage canopy provided some shade, and a breeze smelling of the new sweet grama grass blew in from the steep hills to the south. Myrtle opened the picnic basket to provide sandwiches and lemonade for the two boys and bared her breast to feed Isla. "I hope the train isn't late," Myrtle said as they stared down the tracks, hoping to get a glimpse of the train in the distance. Myrtle's husband of 15 years, Miles Andrew, left the family in February to go to take the cure for diabetes from a doctor in Minneapolis, Kansas. He had improved to the extent that he would return home to the farm on this June morning to resume life with his wife and three children. Miles had not been feeling well since 1902 when they left their Layton farm to move to town, where he took a job at the State Bank. Miles had completed the business curriculum at the Stockton Academy, where he met Myrtle in 1890 when she was an assistant geography teacher. He was advised, however, by the doctor that he needed some air. So he and Myrtle took a trip to the Portland World Exposition in 1903. He felt well enough to purchase another farm in 1904 and build a fine house and barn on Pleasant Ridge. Finally, the verdict came. The water tasters, ask me later what that is, confirmed that he had diabetes. Diabetes had been recognized as a specific disease since the dynastic period in Egypt and was a worldwide occurrence. Nevertheless, most people died of something else as child or adult, so diabetes was considered a not very serious threat, just a slow and agonizing death. The cause of diabetes was not recognized until the early 20th century, and insulin care was not available until 1923. Thus, only folk and herbal medicine was available when Miles was diagnosed in 1905. The starvation cure seemed to be the most effective, where the patient was forbidden all carbohydrates and was allowed to eat only protein and fat. One can only surmise that Miles took the starvation cure in Minneapolis, in that it was effective enough for him to return home on July 9th is evidence enough. How would he look? Such treatments usually left the patient weak and near starvation. 12 o'clock came. The train appeared, huffing and venting steam and black coal smoke. The boys jumped down from the carriage and ran to greet their father when he stepped down. Miles did not appear. Myrtle's heart skipped a beat. What was wrong? Had Miles missed the train? The station master returned to the depot and reemerged with a telegram. Miles Masters died in his room in Minneapolis this morning. Myrtle and the older children were dumbstruck. Myrtle said, "This can't be. He was getting well, and he was going to come home today." Amid the tears, the station master shook his head and said, "I'm sorry, Mrs. Masters, but the telegram just arrived." Okay, maybe one more. This one is short, and it's important to take note of the fact that I'm wearing a safety pin in my lapel regarding this story, okay? This story is titled Safety First. It's about a fifth anniversary trip that Shirley and I took. Instead of narrative, I've written this story because it had many different things associated with it, and this is just one thing. We arrived at the Salvador airport early, eager to board a flight for Rio that would take us home to Kansas. This was 1988, our fifth wedding anniversary. Flight information flashed à confirmer, an indication that departure was to be confirmed, but there was no initial cause for concern. Salvador, the coastal capital of the state of Bahia in northeast Brazil, the nearest point in South America to Dakar, Senegal, had been the entry port for Portuguese sugar plantation slavers in the 18th and 19th centuries. With its broad sand beaches, craggy shoreline, and white red tile roof colonial architecture, Salvador retained its old charm, although its only real income today was derived from fish and tourists. Its run-down but still majestic churches, desperate child beggars, laundry hanging over the streets, white-turbaned women serving moqueca, cacao pods rotting in the streets, open-air fish markets, and huge guanas in the thorn trees gave Salvador an exotic, dangerous feel. A few days earlier in Rio de Janeiro, along the beach along the hotel strip near Copacabana Beach, we had been initiated to the dangers of roving bands of children from the slums. I was attacked twice one evening, once by shoeshine boys, and then grabbed by a young man and his accomplice who attempted to steal my watch within feet of the door of Hotel California. The hotel clerk had been firm, put passports, wallets, purses, rings, and watches in the hotel safe, carry only enough currency to pay for dinner. I disregarded this warning, putting our passports in my shirt pocket, which I then secured by a big safety pin. That's their first clue right here. I adopted this same strategy in Salvador when we were in crowds of desperate, starving children selling prayer bands, imploring the Virgin to cure our bodies. We went out only in daylight, so we didn't really have any problems, but now we were ready to go home. Well, the airline soon announced that our airplane was grounded at an obscure jungle airport 1,000 miles away in the Amazon with mechanical failure. Adversity develops camaraderie, and our fellow passengers suddenly became our best friends. We bonded with the only other English speaker in the waiting room, William, a young man from Connecticut traveling alone. He owned a restaurant and was taking a break in an exotic part of the world. It was finally announced our plane would not be arriving at all. It could not be repaired, and we were to be placed on another flight bound for Sao Paulo and then put back on an international flight that's happened to stop in Rio. But we clung to our new friend William and continued together to Sao Paulo and boarded our flight to Rio. As we said goodbye to William in the airport at Rio, it suddenly struck me. William is gay. This was 1988. When fear and paranoia about acquired immune deficiency syndrome and HIV terrorized the gay community. Symbolism of the time required that one wear a huge safety pin on one's shirt pocket. The safety pin meant I practice safe sex. Okay. Maybe a couple of questions. We have a short... questions?
This was excellent and profound. Would you want to elaborate on that? We gain a sense of spirituality from discovery and visualization. How do we do that, discovery and visualization?
Well, visualization is all up to you. It's a personal experience, and as you study and retrieve memories about your parents and incidents of the past and your place of birth and so forth, it is a matter of... It's a personal matter of your memory recalling the precise visual images of those places and how people looked. It's not something I can tell you how to do. It's just up to you. I have a copy of my notes for you, Les. They're much more elaborate than I had time to present, so maybe that will help.
Thank you. Hi, Bryce. That's great. I enjoyed your talk. But you and I are the same age. We've talked about stuff like this before. I think you're a little older, 2 months or something. But as kids, I'm sure, although I grew up in rural Indiana and Wisconsin, and you grew up in rural Kansas, probably we had the same experience in that looking back and maybe the first 10 or 15 years of our lives, we have no more than maybe 20 or 30 photographs of ourselves. We have no tape recordings, almost certainly. I have about 3 seconds of an old 8mm movie and so on. Okay. And then flash forward to this time when we have iPods and all kinds of stuff in our ears, and the carbon and the silicone in us are conjoining. And there are people out there, and you probably know about this, who are recording every moment of their lives, mm-hmm. every moment of their lives. And so given that, my question is, do you think that since they, Fanny Ann or whoever said, those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it, which mm-hmm. implies that if we do remember it, then life will somehow be better. Well, okay, the question then is sort of apparent. With these people who have every moment of their lives recorded, or any teenager now who's recording so much of his life, and others are too, are they going to have a better history because of that, or a better future? You know, I've been thinking about this lately. I don't know if that is anything you're interested in talking about or not. I hope so.
Well, I guess my reaction is more cynical than practical. I'd say that those things will be lost in the noise, and there's so much of it that it'll be difficult to retrieve. We hear these terms today, data mining, and you can talk about memory mining and using the computer to go back and retrieve all of those things. But it's hard enough to go to the Historical Society and go through all the newspapers and find what you need, even though computers make that easier. I just think it's going to be lost in the noise of all that out there. Who's going to save your text messages? Are they being saved? And all your Facebook interactions. That's all I can say. Sabrina?
Well, I'd like to say basically that not everybody doesn't write letters anymore. I still write them, and I'm sad to say that you can't find any decent stationery anywhere. I write my friend to Japan, and I write my cousins in prison, but my friend in Japan, the only time I ever email him is basically if I want to find out if he's okay. There was something going over Japan, like a big storm or something, but... Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I don't know if all this data mining, all this technology is anything bad. It's just we're gonna, because some of us don't record everything because we're lazy or something. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, we're near our end of our time.
One more comment. The latent biologist in me feels compelled to remind us that without having to work at it, we are the living, breathing history of the earth. I was watching a squirrel out there. Not that your talk wasn't totally compelling. I was both listening to you and watching the squirrel out there. And that's my reminder for today. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you. For our closing musical event, we're going to play 1 minute of my mother playing the piano. She'll be 105 next month. I recorded this back in May, about an hour and a half of her playing the piano, and we've selected just a segment. She, even though her her memory is bad. The one thing she retains is the ability to play the piano, and from pieces from memory, and she can read music. She can transpose keys from one piece to into something she's more familiar with, and that's what remains of her memory, and I think that's astounding. So about 1 minute, and then I'll have some closing words. At a young age, and played for her Methodist church for 80 years. She was still the principal pianist when she fell at age 98 and had to go to the nursing home. They were thrown into a great crisis because their pianist was gone, all 20 members of them. Closing words. Who am I but thinking man, the intelligent ape, Homo sapiens, capable of remembering who I was yesterday and the day before, knowing where I came from, managing my memories, discovering the past through examining the past. I am uniquely conscious of my surroundings. I am the product of 3,000 generations of physical and cultural adaptations after my grandparents, the metaphorical Adam and Eve, walked out of Africa. Yet I am insignificant to the cosmos, one of 7 billion alive today, each of us with unique experiences. Well, who cares? Well, I do, because I am the survivor, the product of a game of chance. The odds of my being here are 1 in 100 billion thinking humans who have passed this way in 60,000 years. War, pestilence, and plagues have winnowed the potential survivors, but I survive. I have an obligation to future memory. I must pass it forward, or no one will know who I was. My short time here will have no meaning. My footprints will soon be erased by the shifting sands. We are done. Thank you.